which is matzah, flour, you know, which is matzah flour. And Shavuos, you have wheat that is chametz. That itself is a very interesting point. The Gemara itself points out that barley food was largely animal fodder. In those days, people did not eat barley. Wheat is human food. So one point the Gemara makes is that Pesach, which is physical freedom, that's not yet connected to accepting God's rule, you're free like an animal, but you haven't yet achieved human dignity. It's only when you take your freedom and you accept in that freedom submission to the will of God, you've made the metamorphosis from animal to human, right? So that's a very familiar teaching, why we go from barley to wheat in the transition from Pesach to Shavuos. And in fact, as we pointed out yesterday, one of the main ideas of the Omer is a period of counting which links the two holidays of Passover and Shavuos to remind us all that there can be no freedom without responsibility. There can be no liberty without commitments. Right? This is a theme that even secular people recognize in many places, that part of the problem of society is we elevate freedom, but we don't talk about responsibilities and duties and obligations. Sviras HaOmer is a line that connects freedom with responsibility to God, and by going from barley to wheat, we indicate under those circumstances that we go from the animal that's freed from a cage to a human being that is made in the image of God. So that's a very, very basic and important idea of linking freedom with submission to the Ol Malchus Shemayim. Even the famous verse when Moshe says to Paro, "Let my people go." Okay? And you often see this as signs in front of synagogues by Russian Jewry, you know, "Let my people go." But we often forget the next word. "Let my people go so that they may serve me." Shalach ami v'ya'avduni. So it's not just "let my people go." It's "let my people go." Actually, it doesn't even say "let my people go." It says "send my people." Actually, it's more of an active thing. Shalach ami v'ya'avduni, so that they will serve me. People conveniently forget the last word in that sentence. Now, what about the second discrepancy, that the Omer was matzah flour, was not allowed to rise, but the Shtei Halachim was allowed to rise? Well, here the Maharal of Prague has some very beautiful ideas. He has a number of ideas, but his basic approach is this. Chametz, as we know, is actually symbolic. It's a symbol. Chametz bread is a symbol of the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. I'm sure you've heard this. And in fact, when we talk about destroying the chametz in preparation for Pesach, symbolically that also means to destroy the evil inclination within. Why is chametz considered to be Yetzer Hara? Well, one reason is because it's puffed up, right? Chametz is filled with air. And that's a symbol for arrogance and conceit and egotism that can often take a person away from God. Matzah, which is compact and it's not filled with air, represents humility. And humility is the greatest way that one becomes close to God. Another reason why chametz is compared to the Yetzer Hara, the Sfas Emes says, because chametz is easier to eat than matzah. Chametz, you know, it's soft. And that represents ease and decadence and comfort, as opposed to matzah, where you got to work a little harder to get through it. And that represents the concept of commitment to striving and effort, which is also spiritual growth. Now, be it as it may, therefore, the concept is you got to try to work on destroying your Yetzer Hara. So the question is, but on Shavuos, the actual korban we bring is chametz. So here the Maharal says is a very important lesson, that through the medium of Torah life, Shavuos is the giving of the Torah, we can learn to sublimate and use in a positive fashion even those aspects of our personality that you might consider to be evil, negative, Yetzer Hara. So for example, all of us know that Judaism is not a religion of renunciation. Judaism does not say that the physical urges that a human being has, whether it be for food or whether it be for sex or whether it be for money, we don't condemn them as evil. And we don't say that in order to be a holy person, you have to have chastity, or you have to have poverty, or you have to fast. In fact, we have certain fast days, but we actually discourage people to simply fast in the middle of the year, although there were such people who did it, but generally speaking, the Gemara says, anybody who says, I'm going to fast all day because I want to be a righteous person is considered to be a sinner. The Nazarite. Nazarite is a person, the Nazir. He takes a vow to abstain from wine. In the Jewish tradition, that's considered to be somewhat sinful. Because if God gave us pleasures in this world, God wants us to enjoy them within limits and within moderation. So what the Torah says is this. The Torah does not say, as let's say different forms of Christianity or Eastern religions say, that this physical world is evil and must be escaped. But the Torah says you can use it and elevate it for good reasons. You can eat for the sake of heaven. You can make money, but then use it to help people by giving tzedakah. The sexual urges can be used in the context of a loving, committed marriage, where you produce, we have children and the like. So everything that might be considered animalistic and it might be considered, you know, unspiritual, in fact, can be spiritualized and elevated and made into a holy thing. The Maharal says that's the remes, that's the illusion. Why on Shavuos, which is the day of Matan Torah, we can even bring in the chametz to the temple to show that all human activity, even those that are associated with things that might often be negative, in fact can be elevated and sanctified and made good. Right? So that's the idea of the chametz, that the Torah can spiritualize everything. Now, that doesn't mean every manifestation, right? That doesn't mean you can do anything you want and call it a mitzvah. But it does mean that the Torah gives us a way to satisfy all legitimate human needs, that we do not consider them foreign to living a life of godliness and a life of sanctity. That's one of the fundamental differences between Judaism and a number of other religious systems. I won't say Christianity, but I would say Catholicism in its classic model, which did believe that the sexual urge, among other things, was a sinful urge. And Paul says in the Gospels that the reason God permitted marriage is people were going to have sex anyway. So God, as it were, gave them a way to have it in a permissible framework. And it's kind of a b'dievet. That's why l'chatchila, if you're really a holy person, you know, you take a vow of chastity and the like, which now, of course, the Catholic Church is grappling with in terms of the fact that there are many, the applicants for priesthood have declined precipitously, and many observers think it is because chastity is not considered a realistic option for many people.
What was he, by the way, Paul? Was he one of these what are the Pharisees? What was the group that?
There's an old rumor. There's a little bit of sort of support for it that Paul was actually a member of the Sanhedrin, who was a fifth columnist. He entered Christianity for the purpose of ensuring that Christianity would become a distinct religion and separated from Judaism. You have to understand, very early Christianity, let's say in Jesus' lifetime, wasn't really called Christianity yet, or right after Jesus, was really a sect of Judaism. Christianity started as a messianic sect within Judaism. I mean, Jesus in the New Testament says he's Messiah. Mashiach's coming, right? Jews believe in Mashiach, etc. But of course, his doctrine involved abrogating mitzvahs and the like. So there was a lot of confusion. There were many the idea, like you have today, messianic Jews. I mean, then, early Christians were largely Jews. And consequently, there is a recurring story that Paul was appointed by the Sanhedrin to kind of, you know, make believe he was a follower of Jesus and separate Christianity from Judaism so it would not confuse Jewish adherents. So the truth is, Paul is the real founder of Christianity as a separate religion. Whether he was a member of the Sanhedrin doing it for Judaism's sake or not is a speculation. But there is that hypothesis.
Where is that written?
There's a book about it. I don't remember the name of the book, but yeah. But the fact that Paul was the one that really made the break, that is basically accepted. I mean, as far as Jesus was concerned, he just claimed to be Mashiach.
But but
like the notion of making a new religion, etc., that really is from Paul, which is after Jesus.
Paul got not wrapped into that stuff, though. He didn't exactly like go back to Judaism.
No. Paul stayed where he was. Paul stayed with Christianity.
Yeah.
But Paul was the really founder of the Christian religion.
Is there any Talmudic source for the existence of Jesus? So many people question.
Very interesting. The Talmud has actually quite a lot of discussion about Jesus, but virtually all of it was censored out. You know, in the Middle Ages, Jewish books were heavily censored, and often the people who would censor them would be renegade Jews who knew how to read Hebrew, who converted to Christianity, and all of the passages about Jesus were systematically ripped out, and the Talmuds were printed without those passages. But there were various manuscripts from which they did appear, and some of the newer editions of the Talmud print them, put them back in.
So they all, we have them all.
We do have them. And I'll tell you the best book on this. The best book was written by an Anglican cleric, an English priest, Hereford. His name was Hereford, H-E-R-E-F-O-R-D. He was a Judaophile. He very much loved Jewish books. In fact, he also translated Pirkei Avos, etc. You know, so he did a lot of translation. And he gathered together all of the passages. It's called Christianity in the Talmud and Medrash. And what's good about the book is he gives you all the passages in Hebrew, which he then translates and annotates. So even if you're not sure about his translation, assuming you printed the Hebrew correctly, I don't assume that he didn't, you can go back and actually read the Hebrew passages and see what it's about. So he comes up with it. The book is around 300 pages, so he has a lot of stuff there.
Did you say Jesus claimed to be the
Messiah? It seems to be that the maximum claim that can be traced to Jesus was at least the possibility, I'm not saying definitely, the possibility that he claimed to be Messiah. But you have to understand that he wasn't even the only one then. Keep in mind that Jesus was shortly after the Second Temple, or the waning years of the Second Temple, when Eretz Yisrael was under Roman domination. And there were a lot of, you know, there was a ferment, there was a hope for Mashiach. The Bar Kokhba revolution took place. Rabbi Akiva thought Bar Kokhba was Mashiach. So he was just like one of, you know, 100 people who said, "I'm Mashiach." So there wasn't the notion of being God, and even the references to Son of God, you know, number one, a lot of the stuff in the Gospels which quote Jesus are not necessarily Jesus' words anyway, they're words that were put into his mouth. And number two, Son of God can mean different things. So in the Jewish tradition, Jesus is regarded as a Jew. He's regarded as a student of the Tanaim of the Mishnah. In fact, there's a whole story. It's an amazing story of how Jesus separated from Judaism. The story is this. The story was he was a disciple of a great Rabbi Yehoshua. He was a famous rabbi in the Mishnah. And what happened was they were sitting at an inn and they were eating dinner. And Rabbi Yehoshua said, "How beautiful is this achsanya?" Now achsanya is an ambiguous word in Aramaic. Achsanya can mean inn or achsanya can mean hostess. So Rabbi Yeshua was commenting on how beautiful the inn was. But Jesus misunderstood, and he thought he was commenting on how beautiful the waitress was. So he said to Rabbi Yeshua, "Well, I didn't like her eyes." You know, so so it was a bad move. So Rabbi Yeshua said, "That's what you think about? You know, you look at the women and everything else." So to kind of give him Musser, Rabbi Yeshua didn't talk to him. So kind of gave him the silent treatment. And every day, for 40 days, Jesus went to him, he's called and asked forgiveness. And Rabbi Yehoshua didn't answer because Rabbi Yehoshua felt he didn't do enough tshuva yet. And then it was the last day, and Rabbi Yehoshua said to himself, "If he asks me today, I'm going to forgive him." And Yashka said, "If he doesn't forgive me today, that's it." And luck, as luck would have, it's not luck, everything is shared, but as misfortune would have it, Yashka asks for mechila. Rav Yeshua is in the middle of reciting Shema, and he's not allowed to interrupt. So Yashka, you know, has it, and he decides to go to Egypt and forsake the Torah and everything else. But you know what the Gemara's lesson is? And this is fascinating. The Gemara's lesson on this whole story is not, "Oh, Jesus is such a bad guy," etc. It says the other way. says that a person should always draw people close with his right hand, and if he has to push them away with his left hand. That's an expression that means the dominant way a teacher relates to his students. The right hand, the stronger hand, is with kindness, compassion, and concern, and the discipline should be a secondary means. And it says, because Rabbi Yoshua used too much discipline, that resulted in the student being driven away. So it's very, very interesting that the Gemara sees Yeshka as an example of the negative consequences of a teacher being overly rejecting in how to deal with a wayward student. So it's a fascinating idea that we don't condemn him. We talk about the mistakes that we made. And the Gemara says that this is also true for parenting, that parenting, of course, there needs to be discipline, and there sometimes needs to even be punishment when necessary, but that should always be a secondary thing. The primary relationship should be one of love. In fact, a religious psychologist I know suggests to parents, so this is difficult, that the ratio between positive and negative reinforcements should be 75 to 25 at least, meaning to say 3 out of 4 interactions should be pleasant and loving, and you know, not more than 1/4 should be negative and critical. If you think about that, again, I mean, if you take a tape recorder to the interaction of parents with children, I think you would find that by and large the ratios might be closer to the opposite. Because when things go well, you know, parents often don't say anything. You know, teachers don't say anything when things are fine. It's only when there's a problem that we start talking. But, this shows you the importance of this positive reinforcement. So there's a lot of stuff about Yeshka. And of course, there's also in the Gemara, there's references to min. You've heard the word min. Min means apostate or heretic. Min is a Talmudic term. But many commentaries feel that min is always a reference to the early Christians. It's not just an idolater, it's a specific reference to the Christians. But the other thing you have to keep in mind, though, is that the rabbis in Babylonia, and Herford makes this point, I think it's a valid point, did not necessarily have intimate knowledge of Christianity, simply because in Babylonia, Christianity was not the non-Jewish religion. So consequently, the details might be greater in the Jerusalem Talmud than in the Babylonian Talmud. Perhaps simply because Babylonia is Iraq. And Iraq at the time, the religion was Zoroastrianism, was the religion in the time of the Talmud. Zoroastrianism was an ancient religion. I don't think there's any practitioners today.
Are there
a few? Okay. All right. That's right. But Zoroastrianism was the ancient an ancient religion which posited two forces, a good force of light and a bad force of evil. And these were two opposing gods. In fact, the bracha that we say before Shema, that God creates light, Yotzer Or, God creates light and creates darkness. The Gemara says that's to negate the idea that light and darkness are two different forces. That's the Gemara says. And the historians say it's precisely because of Zoroastrianism that bracha was put in the before creation.
There had to be a difference between Christianity and Judaism in order to actually make it a clear.
That's correct. That's correct.
I was wondering what the difference was, and Paul went over there and said this is Christianity.
Yeah. Well, first of all, the difference was that Paul diluted Christianity with many pagans and non-Jews. I mean, that was one thing. In other words, until Paul got active, everybody was Jewish. So that itself made confusions. And the fact they used to go to the same synagogues and everything else. Paul brought in a lot of Gentiles who didn't undergo any conversion. So that already, by definition, created a separation. Just from that standpoint alone, he was the great proselytizer of Christianity. But the other thing was the doctrines that, in fact, if we were to ask today, you know, we have a whole group of Messianic Christians, Jews for Jesus, who claim, and it's really very, very misleading, who claim to be Jewish. They say, I'm not Christian, I'm Jewish, and I believe Jesus is Messiah. Now the question, you know, they even wear tzitzis, have beards, payas, some of them, an amazing thing. Oh yeah, some, I mean, not all. That's most. No, no, no. That is most. But there is a segment. Now, you might argue that's just to mislead and entice, and that could be so. But there are some who have hips and beards. I mean, it's a very scary thing. Tzitzis for sure. I've seen Jews for Jesus who have their tzitzis out, you know, tchelas and everything. So it's very important that we understand theologically exactly why is it so that a Jew cannot be a Christian. What is it in Christianity that is offensive to Judaism? And there are really three basic ideas, which are not of equal weight, but there are three reasons why a Jew cannot be a Christian. First and foremost, a Jew cannot be a Christian because to the extent any aspect of God is given a physical or corporeal shape, in terms of Son of God or whatever it is, that is a form of idolatry and paganism, and Jews do not subscribe to Avodah Zarah. That's the first of the Ten Commandments and the second of the Ten Commandments. Now, I do want to say, though, that is not an argument against all forms of Christianity. That's an argument only against Trinitarian forms of Christianity that give divinity to Jesus. Now, if you're a Unitarian, now a Unitarian believes in one God, and Jesus is just a messianic figure, that argument is not an anti-Unitarian argument. Then we have two other arguments. Argument number two is that even if you modestly say that Jesus is just Mashiach, nothing more than Mashiach, we do not believe that that's possible. Of course, this is where you get involved in the Babich. This gets very, very delicate stuff. But the reason is because according to our understanding of Mashiach in the Talmud and the Medrash, there is no second coming. When Mashiach reveals himself to the world as Mashiach, that is when peace is to be ushered in, that is when the exiles are to be gathered, that is when there's supposed to be a Beis HaMikdash. Now, the way Christianity dealt with that problem is by inventing or positing the idea of a second coming, a later coming, that after Messiah dies, he'll come back and finish the job. But we say, once a person is killed without finishing the job, then by definition, the person's not Mashiach. Now, this argument, is where you get into a very, very difficult problem, because obviously many in Chabad do not accept this argument. Because if they say the Rebbe, after death, can come back as Mashiach, right, so the question is, you know, you've negated one of the cornerstones in why Jews can't be Christians. But there's a third argument that I think is the most powerful argument, and the simplest argument, and that is, one of the 13 principles of faith of Judaism is that God's Torah, God's laws, are everlasting. The 613 mitzvahs of the Torah will never be abrogated. Now, the one thing that Christianity does in the New Testament versus the Old Testament is preach that God has abrogated the obligation to keep the commandments. So, whether Jesus is God or Mashiach, or even if he was just a regular prophet, let's assume Jesus would be nothing more than a great prophet. But a prophet who teaches us that the mitzvahs of Hashem are no longer binding as commandments is, by halachic definition, treated as a false prophet. So, those are kind of three particular reasons why a Jew who believes in Judaism cannot be a Christian. One is the divinity issue, one is the Messiah issue, and the other is the abrogation of the commandments of the Torah. And consequently, if somebody was born Jewish and converts to Christianity, they're still Jewish, because you can't convert out of Judaism, but they're not practicing any form of Judaism. It's not the Jewish religion. Excuse me, that they are practicing. Yeah.
I never read the New Testament, but I read the same certain books by Kaplan and stuff that bring out certain verses. And apparently, Yeshua himself said something like, "Anyone who does not observe even the least of these laws will be considered least in the kingdom of heaven." Right. And then Paul says, "You know, it's not works that matter; it's faith."
Right.
So there's a whole complete contradictory statement. And then they decided to say, "Hey, Paul's the easy way. Let's go with Paul." I mean, it doesn't make
Matthew
any
sense. Matthew says, "I have not come to destroy the
law."
The law.
That is true. But that itself is a very ambiguous pasuk, because what that might be saying, depending on how you interpret it, is that by focusing on spirit rather than letter, I am actually fulfilling the law on a higher spiritual level. I mean, it's not necessarily saying keep the mitzvahs. It might be saying let's look at the spirit of the law and then don't get preoccupied.
I remember reading that.
Yeah.
It says pretty much specifically.
Yeah.
You gotta
get that. Right. Okay. But again, Paul. Yeah.
Matthew
right.
is much more Jewish oriented. Just
right. But Paul was the great guy that kind of, and again, maybe he did it for our benefit. But Paul was the great guy that created this separation. Now, how do we get onto Jesus? I don't know. But okay. Oh, yes. I know what we're talking about. We were just mentioning the fact that on Shavuos you could even have chametz bread, because chametz is even the evil inclination, but we don't reject it. We believe it can be brought into Judaism and made something holy and proper, which is a real important foundation that Judaism is not an ascetic religion. It's not a religion of renunciation. It's a religion of life, which gives legitimate expression to all of the urges that a human being has. So that's the idea of the chametz, right? So now we've bracketed it. Shavuah, Pesach is barley, animal food, matzah, but Shavuos, we now come to human dignity and can even be chametz. Counting of the Omer is preparation for that stage. And in fact, in Kabbalah, there's a very interesting thought that's expressed. Could you pass me the sitter, the actual sitter? Yeah. Sorry?
Yeah, like counting from chesed, shiva chesed.
Right. Right. In other words, you have 7 weeks. Okay, you have 7 weeks in Sfira. And Kabbalistically, there are seven types of emotions or interactions that God has with the world. They're called the spheros, the various ways God interacts. And they're called chesed, loving kindness. That's the giving impulse. Gevura is strength. That's the withholding. And of course, chesed needs gevura, because too much giving would destroy us. Just like if you give your child unlimited candy, it'll ruin his teeth, so you have to know how to hold back. So God also knows, he gives us too big of a jolt of his presence, we're going to explode. We can't live. So there's chesed, gevura, and then tiferes is beauty. That's the synthesis, the optimal combination of chesed and gevura. Netzach is eternity. I'll try to explain what that is shortly. Hod is glory. I'll come back to that. Yesod is foundation. And malchus is kingship. Okay, well, I'll try to explain, but just in terms of understanding the basic seven. So there's chesed, kindness, gevura, inner strength, tiferes, beauty, netzach is eternity, hod is glory, yesod is foundation, malchus is kingship. And every week, therefore, is considered to be connected to that particular vehicle of divine energy. So week number one is chesed, week number two is gevura. We're now in week number three, okay? So we're in the week of tiferes. Now, the thing is, every week has one of these things, but every day within a week, because there are 7 days in a week, is also connected. So day one is called Chesed of Chesed. It is the day of Chesed. That's the second night of Pesach. The day of Chesed within the week of Chesed. Day two of the first week, which is the third day of Pesach, is the day of Gevura, the day of inner strength within the week of Chesed. Just like day one of the second week is the chesed of the gevura. Right? One is the gevura within chesed, the other is the chesed within the gevura. Now, according to Kabbalistic tradition, each of these seven midos is identified with a biblical personality. Avraham is identified with chesed. Yitzchak is identified with gevura. Yaakov is identified with tiferes. Moshe, though we go out of order, right? Moshe is identified with eternity, Netzach. Aaron is identified with Hod. And Yosef is identified with foundation. And David, Mashiach, is identified with Malchus. So we talk about the week as being the week of Yaakov Avinu. Now let's explain this a little bit, just on a very simple level. The Sviros are the way that God channels his light and his beneficence and his goodness into the world through these various mechanisms. And there are human beings, as it were, who exemplify in their lives that particular aspect of godliness. Now, although we have seven, but the basic thing is, the basic is the first three. The first three is the basic triad. And that is, chesed is the impulse to give. Gevura is the need to restrain. And tiferes, beauty, is the optimal mixing and blending of the proper proportions. In other words, tiferes is the mixer that properly combines the giving and the restraining impulse. Now, and that's basically something that all of us have to do in our lives, right? We all have to know when to give, when to take, when to hold back, when to let go, right? Chesed is that impulse to keep on giving. Gevura is that potentially selfish impulse to withhold. Tiferes modulates and directs when to give, when to hold back, etc. Now, Avraham being identified with chesed is a fairly simple idea, right? Avraham's dominant way of serving God. That's why Avraham had one bad son, had a Yishmael and a Yitzchak. Had too much chesed results in a looseness, a lack of moral fiber, a lack of commitment, which, again, and the analogy is very simple. If I let my child have all the candy that he wants, that might be, on some level, giving into the chesed impulse. But it's ultimately injurious. And in the spiritual way, it's that way as well. So thus, Yitzchak represents the opposite. Yitzchak represents the koach of gevura. Now, what is gevura? Gevura, we sometimes mistake as punishment. It's not really punishment. It's withdrawal, concealment, holding yourself in. So a gevura person is one of discipline, one of restraints, one of introspection, right? One who works on himself. That's why Yitzchak is the korban, the sacrifice that was given to God. But in parenting, once again, we could imagine too much gevura results in being deprived of the light of God. And thus, if Abraham's chesed produced the Yishmael, Yitzchak's gevura produced an Esav. Now it is said in Chazal that Yaakov Avinu represents the midah of beauty. The word is tiferes. Now tiferes is also identified as emes, truth. Very interesting. John Keats, the English poet, said, truth is beauty, beauty, truth. Well, although Judaism does not preach the absolute supremacy of aesthetics, but it's very interesting that in this Kabbalistic terminology, the alternative word for beauty is truth, because what that indicates is truth is neither total chesed nor total gevura, but the blending of the two to create a beauty, just like in a tapestry. The beauty of a painting or a tapestry is not in being monochromatic. One color is not going to, right, unless you have modern art where they, you know, put up a canvas of white and say, you know, this is a masterpiece or whatever. But generally speaking, you need a blend of colors, and that creates the beauty. Tiferes is chesed and gevura, and it is said that that's exemplified in the life of Yaakov Avinu, and that is why, although Yaakov's kids had their own problems with Yosef, but all of Yaakov's children formed the Jewish people. Because when you combine chesed and gevura, you do achieve a spiritual perfection that you couldn't achieve otherwise. By the way, just a little comment about marriage. It's very interesting that you see in the marriage of Avraham that if Avraham represents pure chesed, you see that Sarah represented the gevura in the relationship. Thus, for example, when Sarah saw that Yishmael was a corrupting influence on the family, and Sarah said, you got to send him away, Avraham couldn't do it. A chesed person cannot do that. It needed to be counterbalanced by gevura to send him away. Similarly, if Yitzchak represents gevura, it's interesting that the outstanding trait of Rivka, as described in the Chumash, was her compassion and willingness to give water, even to the camels. That gives you an interesting insight in marriage. That is, the concept is, one should marry someone who will bring out the aspect of their character that is dormant. In other words, you don't marry a clone of yourself, meaning if you tend to be a gevura person, you need a complementary spouse who's a balas chesed. If you tend to be a balas chesed, you need to be counterbalanced by someone that has more inner restraint. I don't mean selfishness. I mean, you don't live for somebody. You know, I'm a good guy. I have to marry somebody rotten. And, you know, that way. I don't mean that type of balance. But the concept is that if you're always, you know, giving everything away without thinking about it, and without determining what's the proper proportion, you meet someone who's a little more introspective in their judgment. That is the concept of the balance. You don't marry a clone of yourself. You marry somebody who can bring out an aspect of reality that you're not so good in. So there is some truth in the old saying that opposites attract, or at least should attract. Doesn't mean necessarily they will. They will attract in that particular case. Now let me go a little further. So the Avraham, the Yitzchak, and Yaakov is the Chesed, Gevurah, Tiferes. Now the next three are really considered to be just replications of the basic triad on another level. Let me explain what I mean. In other words, Netzach is just act two of Chesed. Hod, as you'll see, is act two of Gevurah, and Yesod is an act two of Tiferes. And the way it works is the following. Netzach has two translations in Hebrew. Netzach can mean eternity, or it can also mean victory. And that is when God gives us the tools to be able to win over the Yetzer Hara in this world. That's the greatest chesed. What is the greatest chesed God does is when God gives us the moral and spiritual kochos, wherewithal, to be able to defeat the Yetzer Hara. So Netzach is the chesed as manifested in spiritual resources, and thus that corresponds to Moshe Rabbeinu, because what is Moshe Rabbeinu? The one who gave us the Torah. Now, Hod corresponds to Gevura in a positive sense, and that is the following. Let's take a simple example. I see it's in the ornate, so that's what I'm thinking about. Let's take the Jewish mother that constantly plies a person with food, right? So you're sitting down there, you know, on the table from here to there is just laden with dishes, and you've got to have to sit and go through all of them, right? So on one level, that's a form of chesed. But that's a chesed that does not step back and give you the respect of making your own decisions, right? There's a certain aspect of chesed which involves withdrawing to show that you respect the independence and autonomy of another. That form of gevura is called hod. Hod is glory. Glory means I step back. I withhold my agenda, my teaching, to let you shine and let you come forth as an individual. That was the special midah of Aaron the Kohen. Aaron the Kohen, lover of peace, he would let each person feel treasured and cherished. So Moshe is plying you with mitzvos, with Torah, etc., etc. Moshe is like feeding you constantly. Aaron steps back. Now, you understand that there's a negative side to that, because it was precisely Aaron stepping back that enabled the sin of the golden calf. When people say, I want to make a golden calf, Aaron steps back. Right? So there is that danger. But you see, that's why you need the balance. Just like you need a balancing, mediating principle between chesed and gevura, you need a similar mediating principle between netzach, which is plying you with, you know, tons of food, and hod that says, I respect you too much to give you direction. Right? You need a mediating principle. And that mediating principle is yesod, foundation, which corresponds to Yosef. Now why does Yosef represent that mediating principle? Because Yosef, on one hand, was a person who received guidance and learning from Yaakov Avinu. But Yosef had to live his life on his own. Meaning, Yosef is the exemplar of the person who absorbs the teachings, but then is put in a life setting where nobody is standing over him. I mean, there was nobody, I mean, Yosef could have very easily have become an Egyptian. Nobody was forcing him to remain faithful to belief in Hashem or don't want to use the word Judaism, because there was no Judaism per se, but whatever the beliefs, whatever the teachings of the Avos were, right? So Yosef in his life represents the balance between receiving all of this Torah knowledge, but having the autonomy and bechira to do it on your own. Right? So in effect, Netzach Hod Yisod is a replay on the spiritual level of Chesed, Gevurah, and Tiferes. Then we come to the last midah, which is Malchus. And in the language of Kabbalah, Malchus is an empty vessel. Meaning, in other words, God is mediating all of these forces and combinations. Malchus is the empty glass with no bottom through which Hashem pours all of these mixings. And this is how it comes into the earth. Malchus is the revelation of these kofas of the earth. And Malchus, therefore, in the language of Kabbalah, is lesle vigarme klum. It has nothing of its own. It just receives. And that is paradigmatic of David HaMelech, who regarded himself as only a receptacle and a vehicle for the glory of God. David's own life was not his own. Remember, David shouldn't have lived at all. Adam HaRishon, who was supposed to live for 1,000 years, saw that the soul of King David would not exist. So Adam gave up 70 years of his life to David HaMelech, which is why Adam HaRishon only lived 930 years. You see? So again, it's very, very significant, because you know the famous saying by Lord Acton, the British politician of the 19th century, that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. It's important to remember that according to Jewish law, a king has very much, very absolute powers. And that's why it is extra essential that the quality for an authentic Jewish king is humility and submission to Hashem. Now, that's not to say every king had that. We had plenty of bad kings in our history. But the ideal melech is one of humility and submission. In fact, there's even a halacha. When a melech daven Shmoneh Esrei, he is supposed to remain bent over for the entire Shmoneh Esrei. We bow down, you know, beginning and at the end, the melech daven Shmoneh Esrei totally bent over, turning to God in that type of submission. Now, so the way it works is the following. So week one is the week of Abraham, the week of Chesed, week two is the week of Yitzchak. Of course, there's a microcosm within the macrocosm, right? Because each day, etc. Now, here is something very, very fascinating, therefore. Let's think for a moment about before I get to that, so what that means spiritually is that the week of Avraham you concentrate on Chesed, you see. The week of Yitzchak you concentrate on Gevurah. There are definite spiritual ideas that you concentrate on during each week. In fact, I saw a very, very nice kind of wall calendar, a little book. It's called The Spiritual Guide to Sfiras HaOmer, which is based on this idea of Chesed, Gevurah, Tiferes, in which there's a concrete exercise thing to do for every single day of the Omer that corresponds with this. So that's something to work on. But I'll tell you something that's really very startling. So let's take Lag BaOmer. Lag BaOmer is the 33rd day of the Omer. Okay? Now, what does that come out to in terms of this structure? The 33rd day is the, fifth week. Right? So the fifth week is Aro. Right? Chesed, Gevurah, Tiferes, Netzach, Hod. Now, 33 is also the fifth day of the fifth week. Is that correct? Because 29 is the beginning of the fifth week. 29, 30, 31, 32, 33. So, Lag BaOmer is Hod, Sheba Hod, the glory of the glory. It's a double header. It's Aron, Aron. Now, let's think about that for a second. We know that one of the things that we do during the Omer period is we mourn. We don't make weddings. We don't listen to music. We don't take haircuts. And part of that is because during the Omer period, and this is not in the Torah, this is much, much later, much, much later. In fact, originally this was a happy period, but it became sad because the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva died in Roman persecutions, through a plague, etc. And the Gemara says they died because they didn't show proper respect and honor for each other. However, the plague stopped on Lag BaOmer. Some say it continued afterwards, and some say it didn't continue afterwards, but everyone says Lag BaOmer was a hiatus. And that's why on Lag BaOmer you can make a wedding, and that's why on Lag BaOmer you can go to a concert and everything else. Now let's think about this, you see? It's very, very spiritually appropriate that this plague stopped on Lag BaOmer. Because if the plague came into the world because Jews were not showing proper respect for each other, then a day in which the spiritual emanations in the air is Aaron Aaron, double dose of Aaron. And Aaron's whole idea was loving people, pursuing peace, seeking reconciliation. That consequently, if you integrate the spiritual message of Lag BaOmer, the plague is not going to get you. Because you've cured the defect in character which gave rise to the plague. See, that's why Lag BaOmer is the Bedavka today. In other words, it's as if Hashem is saying, if you integrate the message of Lag BaOmer, you will be immune from the plague that comes because you don't show proper kavod and respect. And respect to each other. It's hod, hod, sheva, hod. That's one basic idea of the spiritual preparation. There's another idea, though, which is not rooted in Kabbalah, but it's also an interesting correspondence to 48, and that is, if you look at Pirkei Avos, just find it here, the sixth chapter, Perek Vav, and in fact this has become, if I can mention our Eishet Torah, this has become Eishet Torah's main thing here, and this is the famous 48 ways that the Torah is acquired. Right? From Noach Weinberg is a whole tape series. It says there are 48 characteristics by which Torah is acquired. I won't go through all of them now, but there are 48 ways, 48 things you should do in order to acquire the Torah. So what some people say is that the 48 days, each day you work on one of the particular midas. And the 49th day, which is Erev Shavuos, is you integrate. You kind of go over everything, try to bring it in, and then you're ready for Shavuos. Okay? Now, even here, Lag BaOmer comes out very interestingly. Because if you look at the 33rd Midah in this list, it is to love other people. So it's very fascinating that Lag BaOmer comes up with that connection, whether you approach it Kabbalistically, Aaron Aaron, or whether you approach it via Pirkei Avos, it's the 48 ways, it says, Ohev es Habrios. But that's no accident, because the truth of the matter is that the truths of Torah can be expressed in many, many ways. So usually Kabbalistic truths can also be expressed in non-Kabbalistic ways as well. By the way, this idea that you don't follow chronological order, it's Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, Aaron, Yosef, and David. That's also true for the Ushpizim that we have on Sukkot, you know, the tradition that says on Sukkot we have special guests. Well, the Kabbalistic order of the Ushpizim is first day of Sukkot is Avraham, second Yitzchak, third Yaakov, fourth Moshe, fifth Aaron, sixth Yosef, and seventh David. Sometimes the Ashkenazim who were not into Kabbalah, they changed it to be chronological. But since Ushpizin is Kabbalistic, it always seems to me, Ushpizin is only a Kabbalistic custom. So if you're doing it Kabbalistically, you do it Kabbalistically. You don't change it non-Kabbalistically when the whole custom doesn't have a non-Kabbalistic Kabbalistic origin. Okay, so that's the idea of using Sfiras HaOmer as a preparation for the giving of the Torah. Now again, let me backtrack a second. I'll talk about the depth of Rabbi Akiva's students, because this is very important. Rabbi Akiva was a very interesting person. And sometimes, if you really, because people ask, you know, I mean, all right, 24,000 students, okay, you know, that's bad, but you know, come on. In this century, we had 6 million Jews, you know, dying in a Holocaust, so what are we making a big deal about 24,000 students, right? I mean, some people say, like, you know, what is the big deal there? But just to get a sense of what's going on, you have to remember Rabbi Akiva's story a little bit, and then maybe you get a sense of how enormous this tragedy was. I'm sorry, what time do you have? I don't know what time. Okay, so let me just finish this part. Rabbi Akiva, as you know, was a total ignoramus. He was an Am Haaretz until he was 40 years old. He didn't even know how to read Hebrew. He was an ignorant shepherd. And not only was he ignorant, but he also had a hostility and a grudge against learned people. He thought, maybe he was right, they looked down at him, they made fun of him, etc. And he even mentioned years later that when he was an ignorant person, if he could do this, he would bite a Talmud Chacham, I would bite him, and I wouldn't want to bite him like a dog. I would like to bite him like a wild donkey, because a wild donkey can break a bone, a dog can't. I really would want to, I hated them. Or I'd like to rip him like a fish. He used very, very strong terms. And what happened was, he was working, he was in the employ of a very wealthy Jerusalem citizen, whose name was Kalba Savua. And Kalba Savua had a daughter, Rachel, and Rachel fell in love with the shepherd. They got married. When Kalba Savua heard this, he was so chagrined that he excommunicated his daughter, he disinherited her, and he said he swore he would not give her any of his property. So now they're living a life of poverty, and she encourages Rabbi Akiva to go and study Torah. And she said, and Rabbi Akiva finally is convinced because he sees water dripping on a rock, and he sees over time that the water made a hole in the rock, and he figured if water can make a hole in a rock, then Torah, which is compared to water, can make a hole, an imprint on me, even if I'm as dense as a rock. And he went at the age of 40, and he learns how to read with first graders. I mean, imagine this. And he stays for 12 years. And in those 12 years, and his wife is left all alone. She's impoverished. She's basically widowed because she's not with her husband at all. He comes back at the end of the 12 years. He overhears her telling a neighbor that if he is learning Torah, he could even stay another 12 years. He doesn't even say hello, according to this Gemara. And he goes back, he learns another 12 years. 24 years have gone by, and he comes home. And now he's the greatest rabbi, the Gadol HaDor. He comes home with 24,000 students. And his wife comes out to greet him, this poor woman, dressed in rags. And they don't know who she is, they think she's a crazy woman, they push her away. Rabbi Akiva says, no, everything I am, everything you are, Sheli v'shelachem. Everything I am, everything all of you people have, is only because of her. And then there's a story that Gemara says that in the meantime, Rabbi Akiva's father-in-law really feels bad that his daughter has been living in poverty all these years, so he wants to get released from his vow. He doesn't know Rabbi Akiva is his son-in-law. So he goes to this great rabbi. He hears that this great rabbi is coming to town who might be able to release him from the vow. So he goes to this great rabbi and says, Rabbi, I made a vow 24 years ago that I would never give my daughter anything, but here she's so poor and she's suffering, and is there any way I could get out of my netter? So Rabbi Akiva said, well, let me ask you this. If you would have known at the time you made your vow that your son-in-law would become a learned person, would you have made the vow? Because if you wouldn't have, then the whole vow was made on a mistake. So Kalba Savua said, are you kidding? A learned person? If I would know he would know how to read, I wouldn't have made the vow. So Rabbi Akiva says, okay, the vow is released. Yeah, it's okay. But keep in mind the following. So the 24,000 students is what he brought back after 24 years of being separated from his wife. This was his life's work. And in a short time afterwards, all of them died, except for five. All of them died. Now imagine, just from Rabbi Akiva's perspective for a second, although that's not the only perspective here, what a devastating thing that meant. All of the sacrifice, all of the toil, all of the effort, all of the poverty, all of the separation, all of the loneliness was worth it because of this tremendous thing that was achieved. And then everything was torn apart. So it's not just the loss of the Talmidim, but in retrospect, this whole life. What's left? Nothing's left. And so for Rabbi Akiva itself, we have to remember it was a tremendously devastating, and actually Rabbi Akiva's wife, what this meant. Like everything is worthless. The other thing, though, to keep in mind is a paradox. Chazal say, why did Rabbi Akiva's students die? Because they didn't show proper regard for each other. They didn't care enough about each other. Now, it's very interesting. We're going to read in this week's Parsha, the second, there's a double Parsha, but the second of the Parshas, V'yahavta l'rayecha kamocha. Love, mitzvah, right? Love your friend as you love yourself. And Rabbi Akiva was the one who always taught, V'yahavta l'rayecha kamocha, Zeh klal gadol batorah. This is a great and important klal in the Torah. So isn't it ironical that Rabbi Akiva, who taught that this was the most important mitzvah in the Torah, it would be precisely his students that failed to absorb that particular message in their interactions. Oh, is that that might be an answer. In other words, you're suggesting a possible answer that maybe this was his response to the tragedy. That's an interesting point. That might be an answer. Although I see that many commentaries assume that he was already teaching this and they didn't absorb the message. But what you're saying might very well be an answer. I would also suggest this. I would suggest too. Well, you're saying the origin was this event, but I would suggest maybe the origin was his own experience with his wife, because the concept is this. Rabbi Akiva saw in his own life the transformative effect of someone loving him. Because when we say loving somebody is not infatuation or physical attraction. Loving somebody is seeing what is within them that is special and unique and good. Rachel was able to make Rabbi Akiva into a great Torah scholar because she saw in him that potential and that goodness, even at a time when he could not see it within himself. He saw in his own life what her love did to him, and thus he can go out and teach that loving another person can make all that difference in their lives. See, so I'm suggesting that maybe it goes back even then. So again, it's such an irony that his Talmidim didn't absorb it, but the concept here is that in order for the Jewish people to receive the Torah, we have to be misake this particular sin as well, of not showing proper cover to each other. So, and we'll talk about this tomorrow more by Rikas, but the thing to think about is that when you have a Jewish world in which we are not showing kavod to each other, we are not deserving of receiving Hashem's Torah. God took us away. God took the leaders away when they did not have that idea of kavod for each other. So that's another thing that we have to think about during this period of Sfiras Omer. Yeah, there are two interpretations. The Gemara itself says they died from a plague, but the Midrashim indicate that they essentially were massacred in the Bar Kokhba rebellions, in which hundreds of thousands of other Jews were massacred as well. In other words, they were the casualties of the Bar Kokhba rebellion, which was the last stand after the temple was destroyed to regain Jewish independence. Okay, we'll see you tomorrow, and then be well.
Was it wrong for him to have, I mean, he's learning Torah. I mean, in the Torah, it would be considered wrong to leave your wife for such a long period of time.
Of course it would be, unless your wife had given you permission. In other words, meaning to say that for me to say I'm going to leave my wife because my Torah learning is so important, that would be a very big sin.
So she sent him away initially for the first 12 years.
Yeah, even the first 12 years. He didn't, in other words, this was something that they both agreed upon.
But why couldn't, why couldn't she just be with him, or at least he could visit her once in a while? Why does it have to be
the truth is, he probably did visit her.
I can't imagine. It doesn't make any sense.
There was no reason why there would have to be. On the other hand, the Bali Musar said, you know, why couldn't he say hello? The Gemara records, the second 12 years, he just went back. So they say that you see from here that there's a certain momentum, that learning for 24 straight is not the same as a 12 and then a 12. Like when you break it up, did you see this? The Chazon Ish used to give a mashal. If it takes, let's say, 30 minutes to get a pot of water to boil, but after every 15 minutes you shut off the heat, so even if you have a million 15-minute intervals, it's never going to get to boiling. You need a certain momentum to go. And therefore, he didn't want to stop. He felt it would have interrupted trouble. But he probably did this. The Gemara doesn't say there was no contact at all for those 24
years.
Yes, he did. I don't know if it was during or after or before he went. But according to one tradition, Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha, literally means Rabbi Yeshua, the son of the bald one. It's actually Rabbi Akiva's son. Now, why they call him Rabbi Akiva Korcha, even if he was bald, I don't know. And there's another interpretation. There's a famous Rabbi Ben Azai. He's called Ben Azai, who said that he didn't want to get married because we're taking away from the Torah. So he used to call old bachelors the Ben Azai Club. But there's a Tosfos that says, that there's a Medrash that says Ben Azai actually married Rabbi Akiva's daughter and got divorced. that's a major son. So Rabbi Akiva had a daughter.
Just a daughter, and then this.
He had a daughter and a son.
And then that one son.
As far as I know, he only had a, yeah, as far as I know.